We saw the supporters as soon as we drove down Main Street that morning. "Set Sybil free! Let babies be!" was the first chant we heard from the group. Unfortunately, to this day it's the one I hear most often in my head. The others come back to me when I think hard about those weeks, but they don't pop into my head today like bad songs while I'm seeing patients or brewing coffee. As planned, Stephen and a young associate from his firm were already waiting for us in the parking lot when we arrived.
"You have some fans,"
he said, motioning toward the demonstration across the street. My mother smiled. "Are you behind this?"
"God, no. Don't get me wrong. I'm perfectly happy they're here, but I had nothing to do with it."
The adults all shook hands, and I was introduced to Stephen's associate, a man a few years his junior named Peter Grinnell. Peter lacked Stephen's polish, and it was clear he had a liking for fried dough and sausage heroes. His hair was thin, his skin unhealthy.
"How do you feel, Sybil?"
Stephen asked. My mother shrugged. "I can feel my heart beating pretty fast, but I think I'm okay."
"Well, you look..."
Stephen stopped himself mid-sentence, a pause that was at once awkward and uncharacteristic.
"You look like you're ready,"
he said finally. What Stephen meant to say, I've always assumed, was that my mother looked beautiful. My mother had a cornflower blue clip holding back her blonde hair, and she was wearing a modest, almost schoolgirl-like green kilt she'd bought specially for the occasion. But I think Stephen stopped himself because my father was present. My mother nodded, and my father wrapped his arm around her shoulders.
"It's cold out here," he said to the lawyers and me. "Let's go inside."
"Grandma's not here yet," I said. My father said he would walk with us as far as the front door of the courthouse and then wait for Grandma there. I hadn't realized that Charlotte Fugit Bedford had a sister and a brother-in-law. Somehow I had missed the detail that she had a mother. And no one had told me that the three of them had traveled from Alabama to Vermont to sit in a bench behind Bill Tanner and his deputy and watch my mother's trial. But when I walked into the courtroom, I knew instantly who they were. No one had to tell me. I saw them before they saw me, and so that first morning I was able to look away before our eyes met, and I would have to acknowledge the sadness that had scarred their faces. Although I don't believe I had ever viewed the Fugits or the Bedfords as possessing the sort of evil Bill Tanner embodied, somehow that summer I had managed to forget or ignore that my mother was not the victim in this tragedy, or that, in most people's eyes, she was not the only one who was suffering. 28 possible jurors were sat by the bailiff in 4 rows of 7. The goal was to find 12 jurors and 2 alternates whom both Stephen Hastings and Bill Tanner would accept. A pair of law clerks from Stephen's firm and Patty Dunleavy sat with my family on our bench, but the 3 members of Charlotte's family had their bench to themselves. People wanted to give them their space. Otherwise, there were no free seats in the courtroom. One of the few times I was watching the Fugits, I realized one important part of their family was absent. I leaned around my grandmother and asked the clerk beside her, a young woman I'd been told was named Laurel, "Where's Reverend Bedford?"
"He'll be testifying," she whispered, "so he's sequestered. He won't be in the courtroom until we get to the closing arguments."
"Will Foogie come?"
"Foogie? The little boy," I answered.
"You mean Jared, don't you?"
"No, he won't be here. At least I wouldn't think so."
I fell back against the bench, relieved. It was bad enough having to sit within 10 or 12 yards of Charlotte's sister and mother. It would have been almost unendurable to watch a lonely widower with one of the 2 young sons he was now forced to raise on his own. I had no idea whether Tanner was a fly fisherman, but I knew enough adult men in Reddington who fished that I imagined at the time that he was. He walked as if he were wading through shallow water, stepping high and moving with care. He was tall and thin, and in front of a jury he spoke like a grandfather. He seemed patient and methodical, the sort of fellow who would tie a fly with meticulous care and then stand happily in a river casting his line for hours. It was hard to believe this pleasant man was capable of saying the terrible things about my mother he already had, or that he would soon say much worse. His hair was mostly gray, and his face deeply lined. I guessed he was somewhere in his late 50s. When we left the courtroom for lunch, we passed by a row of women in the back bench who were starting to nurse their babies. My mother had cinnamon toast and hot chocolate for lunch in a diner. Stephen and his little staff never left the courthouse, with the exception of the law clerk named Laurel. She stayed with us when we went to lunch, and it seemed to me her principal responsibility was to help us push by the reporters and tell them, with a smile, that we had nothing to say. I think you're all doing very well, she told us. I think you make a very good presentation as a family. My grandmother beamed, and my mother nodded. Well, you know, she said, her voice completely serious, we've had a lot of years to get that look just right. When I wandered into my mother's office to kiss her goodnight after the first day of jury selection, she was scribbling in her personal diary at her desk. She had never hidden the fact that she'd been keeping a journal for years, and the loose-leaf binders she used, thick, three-ring notebooks covered with thin layers of blue fabric, just like mine, filled the lowest shelf of a bookcase behind the desk. She trusted my father and me to respect her privacy. "Do you want more hot water before I go upstairs?" I asked, and motioned toward her half-filled mug of tea. "No, I'm okay," she said, and she put down her pen and sat back in her chair. "You were so quiet at dinner tonight. Everything okay?" I shrugged. "Guess so." "What did you think of your mom's first day in court? Pretty dull stuff, isn't it?" "I thought it was pretty cool," she smiled. "Glad you're there?" "Yeah, I am. Think this will be over soon?" "Oh, I think so, sweetheart," my mother said, her voice tinged with concern for me. Instantly, I regretted my question. "Stephen says the trial should only last 2 weeks." "And I'm sure we'll win," I said, hoping to give her the impression I was so confident that, on top of everything else, she needn't worry about her 14-year-old daughter. "Oh, I'm sure we'll win, too," she said. "And then everything will get back to normal." She opened her mouth to speak, and I heard in my mind the echo. "Sure, Connie, sure. And everything will get back to normal." But no words came out, not even a whisper. Instead, she nodded. But we both knew in our hearts that Charlotte's death had changed everything forever. For my mother, nothing would ever be normal again. They finally finished selecting the jury this afternoon. There are two people on the final jury who were born at home, but that's just because they're in their 60s. They were born when it was still pretty rare up here to go to a hospital to have a baby. There were also a couple of people in the big pool at the beginning who had had their babies at home, but they were both dismissed. Behind me, I heard Rand swear under his breath when their numbers were called, and they were excused. I turned around to give him a little wink that said, "It's okay. It doesn't matter." But of course it does. Stephen doesn't want me turning around to wink at my family, but I still do sometimes. I can't help it. Sometimes I just have to see Connie. I winked once at her today, too. Just because. I wish Connie were little again. I wish you were little and I were young. Maybe not newborn little, although I did love swaddling the warm and gurgling and tiny thing she once was. I wish she were maybe 2 or 3 again. Connie was the best hugger when she was 2. Just the best. She'd wrap her little arms around my neck and squeeze and squeeze and squeeze. "Hug, Mommy." I love that so much. Sometimes it seems like my life is this record album someone gave me that's almost over, and only the first couple of songs were any good. Sometimes this week I've turned around and seen Charlotte's family, her sister and her mother. Charlotte's sister bites her nails just the way Charlotte did. Seeing her face and sitting so close to her has made me feel absolutely pregnant with guilt. I feel it growing inside me. I half expect to touch my tummy with my left hand and feel something move. A little kick. One of those hiccups. Charlotte's sister despises me. Both she and her mom despise me. And yet the weirdest thing is, Charlotte's family probably wouldn't hate me so if I hadn't tried to say Vale. Stephen says by the time this thing is over, everyone will understand that. He says he'll make sure everyone will see that I could have let that little baby die right there inside his mother, and if I had, none of us would be here right now. He'll show them it would have been an even worse tragedy. From the notebooks of Sybil Danforth, midwife. All summer, and into the fall, I had been afraid that Bill Tanner could send my mother to prison and destroy my family. But it wasn't until the first Wednesday morning of the trial when I looked out the window of the courtroom and saw the gunmetal gray clouds rolling in from the northwest that I began to fear the man was sufficiently powerful to control the weather, too. The skies darkened and the room grew dim as he launched into his opening argument. And to this day, the state's attorneys in Orleans County shake their heads and laugh when they tell stories of the way Bill Tanner timed his outline of the case against Sybil Danforth to coincide with a cloudburst.
No one is going to tell you that Sybil Danforth is an evil person. No one is going to tell you that she is a cold-blooded murderer. Tanner said, If anything, you're going to hear from the defense what a fine person she is. For all I know, they're going to tell you she's an excellent mother, the perfect wife. Maybe she is. Maybe she isn't. For your purposes, however, none of that matters. None of it. Sybil Danforth has been charged with practicing medicine without a license. And she has been charged with involuntary manslaughter. No one is saying she murdered anybody. But she did kill someone. That's a fact. And that's what matters. A young woman is dead and buried in an Alabama cemetery because of Sybil Danforth. And a father is faced with the daunting task of raising two small boys on his own. Charlotte Fugit Bedford is dead because of Sybil Danforth. Pure and simple. Sybil Danforth killed her. That's why we're all here right now. The fly fisherman looked at specific jurors as he spoke. The defense is going to try and convince you that this is a complicated case, with a lot of gray in it, and they are going to parade into this courtroom a whole lot of so-called experts. But you will soon see, this case isn't so complicated. Should Charlotte Bedford have even been allowed to have her baby in her bedroom in the first place? We will show that other midwives, as well as probably every single reasonable physician on this planet, would have said no. The risk was too great. Did Charlotte and Asa understand this risk? It is clear they did not. Either Mrs. Danforth did not appreciate the risk herself, or she chose not to share her knowledge of the risk with her clients. On the day that Charlotte Bedford went into labor, did Sybil Danforth even demonstrate the common sense to consider the weather? No, she did not. Did a woman born and raised right here in Vermont, a woman who must know the orneriness and capriciousness and downright uncertainty of Vermont weather, discuss with the Bedfords the chance that they'd be trapped in their home in the event that something went wrong? No, she did not. And then that night, what did Mrs. Danforth do? She had Charlotte push, and push, and push, hours beyond what any doctor would have allowed, without painkillers. She had her push. Sybil Danforth had the poor woman push for so long that she thought she had killed her. The irony? Sybil Danforth hadn't pushed her to death. She almost had, but not quite. Charlotte Bedford did not die from pushing. It took a 10-inch knife with a 6-inch blade to do that. You will all see, and I am sorry beyond words to say this, that one woman is dead because the individual sitting at that table over there took a kitchen knife and brutally gouged open Charlotte Bedford's stomach in the poor woman's own bedroom, and she did so while the woman was still breathing. He eyed my mother and then shook his head in disgust. My mother didn't flinch, but beside me, my father did. Charlotte Bedford would not have died in a hospital. And Charlotte Bedford would not have died had she been cared for throughout her pregnancy by a physician. Obviously, Sybil Danforth is not a doctor. She is a midwife. And while the women who call themselves midwives claim to have all sorts of arcane knowledge, while they claim to be able to deliver babies, in reality, they know little more about medicine than you or I. Sybil Danforth has never been to medical school. Let's face it, Sybil Danforth is no more certified to deliver babies than the woman at the stationery store who sold me my newspaper this morning, or the teenage boy who filled my car with gasoline. Tanner paused to let the vision grow real in the jurors' minds. A teenage boy with acne and a baseball cap and grubby hands delivering a baby. In the momentary silence, however, I heard the sound of a baby about to nurse in the back of the courtroom, and I was glad. An adolescent grease monkey was a powerful image, but it seemed to me it paled before a nursing newborn. When Tanner resumed, he stood up straight and rested one hand on the rail of the witness stand, then empty. The defense might insist that this trial is about the way the medical profession has stolen the process of birth from the women to whom it rightly belongs. Well, that's hogwash. They might argue that this trial is about the right of pregnant women to choose to have their children at home. That's hogwash, too. This trial is about one thing, and one thing only. Sybil Danforth's pattern of irresponsibility and misjudgment. A pattern that led inevitably to the mistake that cost Charlotte Bedford her life. Tanner might have been about to say more, but the storm spared him the effort. Almost on cue, a gust of wind slammed the first sheet of rain into the picture windows behind him with such force that it sounded like thunder and shook the glass. Like many midwives, she was probably viewed by the village with a mixture of awe and envy, fear and respect, Stephen said, referring to a late 18th century midwife whose diary he had studied. The woman had practiced in central New Hampshire, and her 200-year-old diary had been discovered and published when I was in the sixth grade. Although I had not read the book, my mother and her midwife friends had, and the woman, Priscilla Mayhew of Fullerton, had become both a small saint and a large role model in their eyes. "That's how it's always been with midwives," he said, pacing calmly before the jurors. "To some people, they're witches. Or these days, strange and somehow dangerous throwbacks to another era. But in the eyes of other people, they're healers. Not surprisingly, it always seems to be the women who see them as healers, and the men who are quick to cry witch, or shaman, or meddler. The history of midwifery in America is filled with the names of women lionized by their own gender and ostracized by men. Names like Anne Hutchinson. That's right, Anne Hutchinson, the first religious leader in colonial America who was a woman, was also a midwife. In addition to having a brilliant mind, Anne Hutchinson had the strong heart and gentle hands of a midwife, and she had followers. So what happened to Anne? The men of Massachusetts banished her to the rough woods that, with her help, would become the fine state of Rhode Island. Did they ask the mothers how they felt about this? No, of course they didn't. Stephen continued, and he shook his head and smiled at the jurors, offering them a grin that said, "I'm not surprised. Are you?" I followed his gaze to the group, hoping to see that they were as disgusted as he. I couldn't tell. Vermonters make good poker players. They sat unmoving, their faces almost uniformly reserved, businesslike, and indecipherable. There were 7 women and 5 men on the jury. There was one woman of childbearing age, the principal demographic Stephen was hoping to avoid. She was a woman in her late 20s, with stylish red hair. Moreover, her grandfather had been a physician, and so she worried Stephen as much as anyone on the jury. "Let's face it," he continued. "Women have been having babies in their homes since the beginning of time. And until recently, they were cared for by the likes of Priscilla Mayhew, knowledgeable, tireless, loving midwives. Who were these women? There's one sitting right before you, Sybil Danforth. You will learn that statistically her babies did every bit as well as babies born at North Country Hospital, and her mother's actually did better. That's right, her mother's did better. They had fewer lacerations and fewer surgical interventions. In all of her years of delivering babies and tending to mothers, only one woman died, Charlotte Bedford. We are not going to tell you that her death isn't a tragedy. It is. My God, of course it is. And no one is sadder about that fact than Sybil Danforth. But Sybil Danforth did not kill her, and that is what this case is all about. For God's sake, Sybil Danforth didn't kill someone. She saved someone. Sybil Danforth didn't take the life of one young woman that morning in Lawson. She saved the life of one baby boy. That's what happened. That's the truth. She rescued a baby from his dead mother. The state, of course, is insisting that Charlotte Bedford was alive when Sybil Danforth performed the rescue. Where did this allegation come from? The opinion of a terrified, exhausted, and naive 22-year-old woman, that's where. A woman who hadn't yet seen a dozen births. The state is going to ask you to take the word of this 22-year-old apprentice over that of the defendant, an experienced midwife who has safely delivered over 500 babies. A woman who probably knows more about cardiopulmonary resuscitation and emergency medical treatment than most paramedics. Make no mistake, Sybil Danforth knows about birth, but she also knows about death. She is too well trained to confuse a live person with a dead one. Charlotte Fugit Bedford was dead when Sybil Danforth saved the life of the child in her womb. He turned toward my mother and pointed at her. This woman isn't a felon. She's a hero. Her actions weren't criminally negligent. They were courageous. Finally, the state is going to tell you that Charlotte wouldn't have died had she labored in a hospital. We'll never know that. But it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter because Charlotte Bedford made the informed decision to have her baby at home. The only reason my client is even on trial is because we have doctors in this state who want to see home birth disappear as an option. They want the whole idea to go away. The whole idea that a midwife can do what they do, and do it better, drives some of them crazy, and so they're persecuting my client. Doctors are doing now to Sybil Danforth exactly what men have done to midwives for centuries, since the days when Anne Hutchinson was exiled from Massachusetts. They're trying to drive Sybil Danforth away. And they're trying to do it by charging her with crimes she didn't commit. He nodded at the judge and then murmured a soft thank you to the jury. He then took his seat beside my mother and rested his chin in his hand. At the time, I thought it had been a powerful and impressive argument, and although almost 2 weeks of testimony still loomed, I certainly would have resolved to acquit my mother of all charges had I been sitting in the jury box. But there was something gnawing at me when Stephen sat down, and it wasn't until my family was driving home and I was alone with my thoughts in the back seat of the car that I figured out what it was. Although Stephen had said in a variety of eloquent ways that my mother did not kill Charlotte Bedford, he never did say exactly why the poor woman had died. I could probably figure out, roughly, the number of times I've reread what I wrote on March 15th, because few days have gone by when I haven't looked at that entry. I think I started writing about 4:30 in the morning because I couldn't sleep, and I don't think I stopped until Ran got up a couple hours later. It was the Saturday we met Stephen. That entry's like a car accident to me. I'm drawn to it. I find myself staring at the words. When Stephen and Bill Tanner were giving their opening arguments today, they each had their own versions of what happened, and I kept thinking of mine, what I wrote on the 15th. After all this time, it seems to me that mine's become just one more version, too. Did I really love catching babies once in my life? God, I know I did, because I did it for years, and my diary is filled with the ways I loved it. I just can't remember any more what it felt like. All that pleasure I once experienced has gotten to be like pain, the sort of sensation you just don't remember very well when it's over and done with. Next week, I'm going to sit on the witness stand, and I'm going to tell everyone what I think happened. But the truth of the matter is, I just don't have any idea anymore. From the notebooks of Sybil Danforth, midwife. In the weeks before my mother's trial and the weeks of the trial itself, it was all my parents could do to take care of themselves. Their teenage daughter was certainly not the lowest priority in their lives, but understandably, their attention was not focused upon me. During the nights the trial was underway, I was supposed to be home in my room doing the sort of reading that the adults around me had concluded did not demand either class discussion or an academic's explanation. I'd try and keep up with my English and history, and then catch up in math and science and French when all this had passed. Looking back, I'm astonished that anyone would have demanded such a thing. The adults were exhausted after each day in court, and so was I. Likewise, my parents were too tired to discipline me. Consequently, I spent a good part of the night after the opening arguments, the first Wednesday of the trial, in the McKenna's barn with Raleigh and Tom and Garrett Atwood.
The four of us were so stoned by 10 o'clock that we were actually cupping our hands around the snout of poor Witchgrass and trying to blow the dope we'd just held in our own lungs into hers. The horse got a little giddy, but not like us. By the time I staggered home shortly before midnight, the only lights on in our house were upstairs in my parents' bedroom. I assumed they were waiting up for me and would descend upon me the moment I opened the front door. And so I wandered around to the back of our home and pulled open the storm window on the side of my mother's office. The storm window didn't close properly, and it was easy to open it from the outside and easy to pull myself into the room. Beside the window was my mother's desk, and in the moonlight I could see that one of her notebooks was open upon it. I switched on the desk lamp. Had I not been stoned, I like to believe I would have respected my mother's privacy and left her diary alone, but I can't say for sure that's the case. Hunched over the desk, I started to read, and when I saw what my mother had written about March 15th, I flipped back the pages a full half a year. 2 weeks before the trial began, I listened to my mother on the phone with Stephen Hastings. It was late. The dinner plates were tucked in the dishwasher. My father was upstairs in bed. My mother had already taken a bath. "Sure, I've met male midwives," she was saying, and I wondered if she knew I was nearby. She was curled up on the couch in the den, and I'd come downstairs for a history book I'd left on the kitchen counter. I heard her giggle, and the sound of her laughter had become so rare that I was unable to leave without hearing more. "You'd be terrible, Stephen. Just got awful. You view breasts like a teenager. I hate to think of the way you'd handle a prenatal. You'd have too much fun." "Yes, but it's not that kind of fun." "Maybe someday I will. Sure." With books and pictures. With books and pictures only. I'd seen my mother flirt lightly with the men she and my father had known for years, but I'd never imagined her flirting with one on the phone. Perhaps because my father was absent, perhaps because she was wearing a thin, almost transparent nightgown, this seemed more illicit to me, and I found myself frozen in something like wonder. "It's not an aphrodisiac, I promise. I don't think male OBGYNs go home hot and bothered, do you?" "Well, you're a pervert." "Hold on, will you, Stephen?" she said suddenly. "Connie, is that you, sweetie?" I stood perfectly still until she started speaking again. When she did finally, I turned and tiptoed back up the stairs as fast as I could. Perhaps because I had a vision in my mind of how most of my mother's midwife friends dressed, the endless peasant skirts, I was unprepared for the two women who testified just after lunch, a midwife followed by an OBGYN who had once been a midwife. The midwife, Kimberly Martin, even looked like a doctor to me. She was wearing a woman's blue business suit.
"How long have you been a certified nurse midwife?" Tanner asked her.
14 years.
"Would you tell us what it means to be a certified nurse midwife?"
"First of all, we're all registered nurses. Secondly, we've all graduated from one of 24 advanced education programs around the country that focus on women's health care and midwifery. Third, we've all passed the certification exam given by the American College of Nurse Midwives. Finally, and personally, I believe this is very important, we all meet the requirements of the health agencies or medical boards of the state where we practice."
"Are you a member of the American College of Nurse Midwives?"
"I am. This year I'm also part of the Division of Accreditation." Tanner smiled.
"How many nurse midwives are there in this country?"
"About 2,500.
"Do most nurse midwives deliver babies at home?"
"Oh, no, just the opposite's true. The vast, vast majority of us work in hospitals or birthing centers, almost 95% of us."
"What about you?"
"I have delivered babies at home, but I haven't since I was much younger."
"Why did you stop delivering babies at home?"
"In my opinion, it's needlessly risky."
"You said roughly 95% of nurse midwives work in hospitals and birthing centers, so that means roughly 5% don't?" Stephen asked Kimberly Martin.
"Yes."
"That 5%, do they work in homes?"
"Yes."
"Do they have a higher infant mortality rate than the rest of the group?"
"No."
"About the same?"
"Yes."
"In fact, did any nurse midwife in your organization see any woman die in home childbirth last year?"
"I don't think so, but that doesn't diminish. In fact, none died, Miss Martin."
Stephen said, cutting the woman off before she could elaborate on her answer. Did you know Belle Weber?
I did.
Would you tell us who she was?
She was a nurse midwife. She died this summer in a car accident.
Did she deliver babies at home?
Martin nodded. In Maryland.
Was she a member of your group?
Until she died.
Was she on the Division of Accreditation with you?
Yes.
Was she on any other committees for the American College of Nurse Midwives?
She was chairing the Home Birth Committee.
Your organization has a Home Birth Committee? Really?
The midwife looked annoyed. Obviously, we have such a committee.
Is that because some midwives in your group still choose to practice there?
Yes.
Stephen nodded. Does the American College of Nurse Midwives formally oppose home birth?
No.
Thank you.
Kimberly Martin was followed by another woman who had once caught babies in people's bedrooms and then apparently decided this wasn't a particularly good idea. I must have looked worried or nervous because Patty Dunleavy turned to me and whispered that we had experts too, and ours would be every bit as impressive as these people. But that afternoon it was hard for me to believe we'd have anyone as accomplished as Dr. Jean Gerson. 30 years earlier, Jean had been a young midwife delivering babies at home. Now she was an OBGYN affiliated with a teaching hospital in Boston, a faculty member at Boston University School of Medicine, and the author of 2 books on prenatal care. Dr. Gerson had reviewed the medical history Charlotte Bedford had supplied my mother, and she told the jury that no responsible person, doctor or midwife, would have allowed Charlotte Bedford to labor at home. She wasn't gaining enough weight, and she was anemic. Dr. Gerson was positively telegenic. She was a handsome, dignified woman who smiled when she spoke, the sort of person who was instantly likable. Years later, when I was in medical school, I would recall her face and her voice, and I would find myself wishing I had gone to BU. Ironically, a part of my mother's defense was the fact that Charlotte was indeed an imperfect candidate for a home birth, but not because she was anemic. Stephen planned on making an issue of the fact that Charlotte had been treated for hypertension in Alabama, but had never shared this information with my mother.
"Are many pregnant women anemic?" Stephen asked her.
"I wouldn't say many are anemic, but I would say that many experience some small degree of anemia," she answered.
"Is it treatable?"
"Yes."
"How?"
"Iron tablets, ferrous sulfate, usually."
"You said you've reviewed how Sybil treated Charlotte Bedford's anemia. What did Sybil do?"
"She had her take iron tablets."
"Did her condition improve?"
"Not enough to merit.
Did Charlotte Bedford's condition improve?"
Dr. Gerson offered a broad smile that suggested that she wouldn't stoop to Stephen's level of discourtesy and debate.
"Yes."
He then handed the physician 2 sheets of paper lined with boxes and graphs.
"What are their dates?"
She adjusted her eyeglasses slightly and then answered, "One is from September 15th, 1980, and one is from February 12th, 1981.
"I want to focus on the hematocrit values," Stephen said, referring to the term the medical community uses to describe the percentage of blood occupied by red corpuscles. "What was Charlotte Bedford's hematocrit value in September?"
31%.
"What is it normally?"
"Oh, around 42 in most women, slightly lower in a pregnant woman."
"How about February? What was the woman's hematocrit in February?"
35.
"Is that an improvement?"
"A slight one."
"When one of your patients, a pregnant woman, has a hematocrit value of 35, do you anticipate a bad outcome?"
"That's an odd question, and I'm not sure it's relevant. After all, I deliver babies in hospitals. If you mean would it affect my handling of the woman's preg,
I'll repeat the question. Would you anticipate a bad outcome?"
Dr. Gerson was silent for a moment. Finally, she said simply, "No."
"Thank you."
"You're welcome."
Stephen paced toward the windows. When he had put some distance between himself and the witness, he turned back toward her and asked,
"You told us earlier that Charlotte Bedford's blood pressure was slightly higher than normal. Am I correct?"
"Yes."
"How would you have treated it?"
"I would have watched it very carefully, perhaps placed her on bed rest. I don't know if I would have prescribed an antihypertensive. I might have."
"Would you have looked for protein in the urine?"
"Yes, indeed."
"Based on those records, did Sybil?"
"Apparently."
"Thank you." Is there any indication in Charlotte Bedford's medical records that she had ever been treated for hypertension in the past? I didn't see any. Slowly, Stephen began to walk back toward her. I'd seen him do this enough during the day that I knew it was all part of a strategy of irritation and intimidation. He was about to invade the good doctor's personal space, practically leaning into the witness box with her. Am I correct that there's a box on the form that says patient's history? He asked as he approached. Yes, there is.
And it lists a variety of conditions?
It does. What has been circled in the box? The doctor looked at the form and then read from it. Bladder infections, German measles.
That's it?
That's right.
Have the words high blood pressure been circled?
No. He nodded and prepared for the kill. Sometimes, of course, even the best hunter misses his mark. Sometimes the lion charges. This would be one of those moments. And while Stephen would ask to have Dr. Gerson's remarks stricken from the record, and while the judge would agree, I could not imagine the jury would forget it when they were deciding my mother's fate.
There is no indication that Charlotte Bedford shared her history of high blood pressure with Sybil, is there, doctor?
Bottom line, counsel, the doctor said, speaking quickly but calmly, her voice gently condescending, is that the records show the poor woman had symptoms of both anemia and high blood pressure. Both. No doctor or midwife in her right mind would ever have allowed that woman to labor at home. We drove home Thursday night with the car's heater on. Occasionally, my father would try and cheer up my mother by observing how Stephen had done a fine job taking apart one witness, or how the damaging testimony of another would be negated when Stephen began our defense. Usually, my mother would just mumble her agreement and stare at the trees we could see in the twilight. When we got home, however, there were glass vases of roses awaiting my mother on the kitchen counters. A bunch of red ones, a bunch of yellow, a bunch of pink. My father had had them delivered during the day, and each vase had a large card beside it he'd made himself with old photos of the two of them, architectural blueprint paper, and the binder clips I knew he used for capabilities presentations for prospective clients. The cards were beautiful, and my mother was touched. Later that night, when they were passing my bedroom on the way to theirs, my mother was still talking about the cards and the flowers, and I found myself bragging about my father in phone calls to Raleigh and Sadie and Tom. Friday, as lunch approached, the state squeezed in one more witness, a doctor who explained to us all what a prolonged second-stage labor meant and the dangers it posed for the mother. It was clear the jury thought Dr. Jeffrey Lang was a wise and compelling man. In a particularly brutal exchange from my mother's perspective, he managed to simultaneously explain why pushing too long endangered a woman, while casting yet one more aspersion upon my mother's competence.
It's perfectly reasonable that someone with the limited training of a midwife would suspect a ruptured cerebral aneurysm. Obviously, that's not what occurred in this case. But someone with only rudimentary obstetric education might think such a thing. What did occur?
Bill Tanner asked.
She... and this is a shorthand term some doctors I know use in conversation, vagaled. She vagaled out.
With clinical formality, he then began laying the groundwork for the testimony we would hear that afternoon from the medical examiner. I doubt I'll ever talk to Anne again, so I guess I'll always be wondering, what did she think would happen when she picked up the phone and called B.P. Hewitt? Did she expect something different? Or did she get what she wanted? From the notebooks of Sybil Danforth, midwife. Anne Austin had not worked with my mother for very long, and so she had not become a part of our lives the way her predecessors had. I had barely known Anne Austin when Charlotte Bedford died. Over the years, it has become more difficult for me to differentiate my opinion of the woman after the turmoil from my opinion of her before it. Before it, I believe, she had struck me as a sweet but mousy thing. But I don't think when I first met Anne, I thought she was self-righteous or smug. I don't think I thought she had it in for my mother. That impression grew during the summer and fall as my mother's trial approached. Anne was 22 when she came to my mother, and until that winter, she hadn't seen a baby crown or caught a newborn once in her life. But she had visions in her mind of what a perfect birth was like. Under my mother's tutelage, she studied hard, and my mother thought she was a fine apprentice.
By the time the trial began, however, she had grown in my mind from a mousy little midwife wannabe to an arrogant traitor of almost theatric proportions, pietistic, self-important, and for reasons I couldn't fathom, bent upon the destruction of my family. But when she had first phoned B.P. Hewitt, my mother's backup physician, 6.5 months earlier, I doubt she hated my mother. I doubt she hated her even after B.P. tried to reassure her that she had not witnessed a cesarean on a living woman. When she picked up her phone to call the physician, I tend to doubt she even understood the fusion she was about to trigger, the linear progression of events she was about to unleash, a progression which, in hindsight, could not possibly have had a good end for my family. For all I know, her intentions may even have been kind, her desires noble. A woman was dead, and something had to be done. Yet the stakes must have grown large for Anne Austen that morning, and I would not be surprised if even today she cannot fully explain why she did what she did. Perhaps she thought that BP would share her first phone call with my mother, and that would effectively end her apprenticeship. After all, how could my mother ever trust Anne again after she had called her backup physician behind her back? And so she had to convince herself that she was right, my mother was wrong. She'd call Asa Bedford, find out what he'd seen. And then, once she had broached her fears to the husband, fears reinforced by his own horrific memories, spurts of blood from the woman on the bed, she had to call the state's attorney. She had to. Perhaps she feared that the reverend would if she didn't, and then she herself might be charged as an accessory to a crime. No, I really don't believe Anne Austen hated my mother when she started her phone calls that bitter morning in March. But I do believe she grew to hate her over the summer. I do believe she learned to despise her. She had to. How else could she have lived with herself? By the time the trial began, I am quite sure in Anne's mind my mother was a sloppy and dangerous midwife and deserving of the punishment before her. I could see it the moment she arrived in court Friday afternoon. I could see the loathing she had for us all sparkle in her round, dark eyes. Anne's voice had a slight trace of Boston I hadn't recalled from the winter, and it made her seem stronger, more authoritative. It was during her testimony that the jury began growing uncomfortable and began to steal glances at my mother. Although the panel knew well the outline of what had occurred in the Bedfords' bedroom, they had not yet heard an account from an eyewitness. And as Anne answered question after question, Bill Tanner asked, I think Charlotte Bedford grew real for the first time in some of the jurors' minds. In all likelihood, that was Tanner's plan. All of the individuals the state had put on the stand so far were mere warm-ups for the final three, a troika of powerful witnesses who in theory would seal my mother's fate. Anne Austen and the medical examiner on Friday afternoon. The Reverend Asa Bedford on Monday morning. What I did not appreciate until later that Friday, and what I might not have appreciated for years had Patty Dunleavy not explained it to me, were the subtleties of Tanner's order. The last witness the jury would hear before the weekend, 2 full days during which they would stew upon all they had seen and heard, would be the coroner giving the state's version of the cause of death. Then, if the state had any fears that their case had lost momentum over the weekend, they knew that on Monday morning they had the widower left, a grieving but articulate pastor who was very much accustomed to public speaking. By the time Stephen had an opportunity to cross-examine Anne, most of the jurors must have had a picture in their minds of Sybil Danforth as an alarmingly slipshod midwife, a midwife who became hysterical and panicked, a woman who temporarily lost her mind and grew capable of hacking apart a living woman in the final stages of labor. I noticed that when Stephen stood up to begin his cross-examination, he remained behind his table so Anne would at least have to stare in my mother's general direction.
Prior to Vale Bedford's delivery, you had only seen 9 births, correct? He asked.
Yes.
And none of them resulted in an emergency situation, right?
That's right.
Vale Bedford's was the first, wasn't it?
Yes.
Prior to March 14th, had you ever been in an emergency situation?
No.
And you've never been with an EMT or rescue squad volunteer in a life-and-death crisis, have you?
No.
Charlotte Bedford was the first, wasn't she?
Yes, she was.
And you've never witnessed surgery of any kind, right?
No.
Do you have any formal medical training?
Not yet, but I'm planning on...
Thank you, Miss Austen. You've never even taken an accredited first aid course, have you?
No.
Was Charlotte Bedford the first person you ever saw die? he asked, and for the first time that afternoon, he raised his voice a notch and sounded ready for one of the confrontations he seemed to relish.
Yes.
When you saw the blood that resulted from Sybil's attempt to save the baby, was that the first time you'd ever seen a body opened? I'd seen pictures in textbooks. Please, Miss Austin, I didn't ask if you'd ever looked at a body in a book. Was that the first time you'd ever seen a body opened?
I guess.
Yes?
Yes.
Thank you. So, prior to the early morning hours of March 14th, you had never seen the quantities of blood that might or might not flow in that situation, correct?
Yes.
You'd never seen blood spurt from a living or a dead body?
No.
In that case, what in your background led you to make the wild assumption that the blood you saw that moment was coming from a living woman?
It was the way it spurted.
He shook his head. I'm not asking what you think you saw. I'm asking you what in your background led you to think that based on the bleeding, Charlotte Bedford was alive.
You didn't see it. If you had been,
Your Honor, please instruct the witness to answer the questions, Stephen said abruptly. Judge Dorsett looked down at Anne and said simply,
Miss Austin, you will answer the questions.
But if any of,
Miss Austin, the judge added,
and he sounded almost as annoyed as Stephen,
answer the questions as they are asked. Please.
Mr. Hastings, proceed. What part of your training led you to think that the blood you saw was coming from a living person? Stephen asked. Am I correct in saying that any conjectures you made about the blood were founded on absolutely no experience, no first or second or even third-hand experience? Finally, she looked in Stephen's direction, and when she saw my mother, she shut tight her eyes against tears, but they were too much. She sniffed back some, but her answer was still filled with her sobs. As if Stephen hadn't asked her a question, as if he weren't even present, she cried with the suddenness of lightning at my mother.
God, Sybil, I'm sorry. I'm sorry, but I had to do it. I had to call. You know you killed her.
Stephen tried to cut her off. He demanded the remarks be stricken from the record, and Judge Dorsett slammed his gavel down on his bench. But before breaking down and triggering a recess, Anne managed to sob once more.
I'm sorry, Sybil. I am. I know you didn't mean to, but we both know you killed her.
My mother sipped water from a paper cup in a small windowless conference room during the recess, and my father held her hand.
She is a little witch, isn't she? Stephen's assistant, Peter, murmured.
No, my mother said. She isn't really. Anne's just... she's young, and she's gotten herself in too deep.
Well then, Stephen said, she's about to drown. It will be short and sweet, but we're about to take her down for the third time.
Miss Austin, you will focus solely on the questions Mr. Hastings is asking. And Mr. Hastings, you will allow her to answer each question fully. Do we have an understanding?
Judge Dorsett asked when we had reconvened. Stephen nodded and asked the court reporter to read back the last question he had asked, the one about first or second or even third-hand experience.
That's right, Anne answered. Her eyes were red from crying, and her words were no longer draped in poise.
But nevertheless, when Sybil made the first incision, you decided Charlotte Bedford was alive.
When I saw the blood, yes.
Did the body show any other signs of life as the incision was made, or for that matter, after?
Like what?
Stephen shrugged. Did the woman cry out with pain?
No, she was unconscious.
Did the body shudder?
I didn't see that.
Does that mean that the only indication you had that the woman might have been alive was the blood?
Yes.
Did you try to stop Sybil from proceeding?
No.
Did you say to her, don't do this, Sybil, she's alive?
No.
Did you try and take the knife out of Sybil's hand and,
objection, this is just badgering, Tanner said.
Overruled. Did you try and take the knife out of Sybil's hand?
No.
Stephen nodded. So despite your contention later on that Charlotte Bedford was alive before the incision, you did absolutely nothing to try and save the woman's life. Did you, at the very least, share your fear with the father while the two of you were still in the room?
No, not then I didn't.
You testified earlier that you were surprised Sybil never checked for a fetal heartbeat. Did you suggest to the midwife that perhaps she should?
No,
So I'm correct in saying that despite your claim after the fact that Charlotte Bedford had been alive before the incision, you did absolutely nothing at the time to try and prevent the surgery?
I just didn't know what.
Miss Austin, I just didn't. Your Honor!
Judge Dorsett wrapped his gavel on the dark wood before him, and then surprised me, probably surprised us all, by throwing the young woman a life preserver and thereby preventing her from going under a final time.
Counsel, he reminded Stephen, I asked you to allow the witness the time to answer each question fully. Go ahead, Miss Austin.
She took a deep breath and dabbed her eyes with a tissue. Finally, in a voice that quavered slightly, she said,
I just didn't have the confidence at the time to stop her. I just didn't know enough. Like you said, I hadn't been through anything like that before. But I saw the blood pumping and pumping, and I knew something was wrong. And it was only a few hours later that I decided I had a moral responsibility to tell someone what I'd seen. I didn't want to. Really, I didn't. But I had to. That's the thing. I had to do it.
Perhaps because of the phone call I'd overheard one night between my mother and Stephen, a conversation that seemed steeped to me in flirtatious innuendo, I made a point of being home when he came by our house one afternoon in the week before the trial began. When he finally left, as my mother walked him to his car, they wandered to my mother's flower garden, stopping somewhere amidst the sunflowers, taller than they by far that date in September, but just about ready to die, in a spot I couldn't see. Pressed flat against the side wall of our house, I still couldn't see them, but I could hear parts of their exchange. And so I believe Stephen may have tried to kiss my mother, by the way I heard her saying to him, No, it's not just the place, it's everything. If I sent you those signals, I'm sorry. I'm really and truly sorry. Before I became a doctor, I couldn't imagine why anyone would become a coroner. Only after I'd started medical school did the fascinations of that job become apparent to me. When I was 14, however, I imagined a coroner had to be a very sick person, and so I was unprepared for the medical examiner for the state of Vermont. Terry Tierney looked like any one of the fathers I knew in Reddington who coached Little League baseball in the spring and Pop Warner football in the fall. Energetic but patient, with a black beard that was graying and eyeglasses very much like Stephen's. He smiled when Bill Tanner greeted him. When they finally got around to the scene that had greeted Tierney, when he walked into the Bedford's bedroom back in March, however, Tierney grew serious.
Did Mrs. Danforth tell you how Charlotte Bedford had died? Bill Tanner asked.
She said the lady had had a stroke.
What did you think?
I thought it was possible. Anything's possible in a home birth.
Objection, Stephen said, shooting up from his seat, and the judge sustained it. Did you find any indication that the woman had had a stroke?
No.
If Charlotte Bedford had had a stroke, would you have been able to determine that from an autopsy?
Definitely, absolutely. When I examined the brain, I would have found significant changes. I would have seen hemorrhaging, bleeding. The tissue would have softened. It would have gotten almost spongy.
And you saw none of that? No bleeding, no softening, when you were examining Charlotte Bedford's brain?
No, I did not.
Could you tell where in the birth canal the baby had been when Mrs. Danforth pulled him from his mother?
No.
Could you tell if the baby had descended at all in all those hours Mrs. Danforth forced Charlotte to push? Objection, no one forced anyone to do anything.
Sustained.
Tanner smiled for the jury's benefit, a grin more mischievous than chastened.
Could you tell if the baby had descended at all in all those hours Charlotte was pushing?
No, I could not tell.
Could you tell if there had been a placental abruption?
Yes, definitely. There were areas of hemorrhage.
Was that the cause of death?
No. As it occasionally does, it had clotted over, started to heal itself.
Was it a factor in Charlotte Bedford's death?
It would become one, indirectly.
How so?
The woman had lost some blood during that event. Given the cesarean that would be performed a few hours later, it's impossible to gauge how much, but it was probably a significant amount.
Meaning?
Her body was weaker. She wasn't as strong.
Why might that matter?
As any mother knows, labor's hard work, incredibly hard work. A woman needs all the strength she can muster, especially if something unforeseen occurs.
Based on the autopsy you performed and all of the subsequent laboratory work, what do you think that something was?
Well, although there was no medical evidence of a stroke, there were eyewitnesses who saw what apparently looked like a stroke to someone who wasn't a doctor. The woman twitched or spasmed and then blacked out. The father saw it. The young lady, the apprentice, saw it. And, of course, Mrs. Danforth saw it. But I don't believe it was an aneurysm that caused the spasm.
Do you have an opinion as to its cause?
Yes.
Would you tell us what that is?
To use Dr. Lang's expression, I think the woman vagled.
Would you elaborate?
Right here, in the small of the back of our heads, Tierney said, motioning to the spot on his own head with his hand. There is a pair of cranial nerves filled with motor and sensory fibers. Those are the vagus nerves. Among other things, they help to carry the information from the brain to the heart about how fast or slow it's supposed to beat. Now, like everything else in the body, the brain needs oxygen.